So, yesterday we finished up, mostly we talked in the afternoon session about primary drying and the steps that are involved in constructing this graphical design space. We had a few words to say about secondary drying. So we wrapped that up. And the next piece of it has to do with process monitoring, starting with product temperature measurement and pressure measurement, and we'll kind of go from there. Product temperature measurement, why do we care? Well, we care because the process variable that has the biggest influence or potential influence on product quality is the product temperature. And we also recognize there are a lot of uncertainty around product temperature measurement. Some of that uncertainty is just stuff that you can't get away from because you've got something sticking in a vial of the product. But then there are other things having to do with thermocouple leads and resistance temperature detector leads and so forth that can lead to a whole lot of uncertainty. It seems like a big buzzword at Baxter now anyway. It seems like everybody is always talking about data integrity. Well, generally speaking, the data integrity of product temperature data that you'd get from a production freeze dryer is highly questionable, but we'll get back to that momentarily. So there's all sorts of reason to care about product temperature measurement. We'll talk about the two main ones, thermocouples and RTDs, or resistance temperature detectors. Wireless system, we're very interested in that at Baxter. You may know that LioHub has what I think is a really good idea going in putting together a series of what we call best practice papers. We published one last year about best practice in process monitoring. There's one that's almost ready to submit, or maybe has been submitted, dealing with equipment qualification. There's another one. Sergey's actually heading up that group. He's so busy with other stuff. I think he has trouble getting to it, but he's heading up a group that's directed at best practices for scale up in freeze drying. All of these really good ideas. We need to have one on best practice for process validation. I was talking to Joe, I guess you and I were talking yesterday. I was asking you, why does validation take so long? I've never quite understood that, but it seems to me that it would go a little more smoothly if we had generally agreed upon best practices. Because in companies that I've worked with before, you lose a lot of time debating and meeting after meeting about how we're going to go about this, and often take overly conservative approaches that are just way too time consuming. So I mentioned that because I think we entitled this first publication, we put the date 2017 on it because we expect that best practices to always be changing. And I hope that the next time we write a best practice paper on, process monitoring, that recommended best practice will be some kind of a wireless system. They just have too many potential advantages. I don't think it would be a Tempra system, but some kind of wireless system. So I'm interested in the work you folks are doing on wireless sensing in general. Pressure measurement. There are all sorts of ways to measure pressure. There are only two of them that we'll talk about: the thermal conductivity type gauge or Pirani gauge. That's not the only kind of thermal conductivity type gauge, but it's the gauge of choice. And then is the capacitance manometer, which is an instrument of choice for pressure measurement and freeze drying. And we'll elaborate on that a little bit. And then we'll talk about cycle monitoring in more general terms, including limitations of product temperature measurement, alternatives to product temperature measurement for cycle. Actually, I say cycle endpoint, but I should probably call that cycle sequencing, going from one phase to another, freezing to primary drying to secondary drying to cycle completion. And we'll include things like comparative pressure measurement, manometric temperature measurement, pressure rise, tunable diode laser absorption spectroscopy, a little bit about mass spectrometry. It was a developing tool that's, I think, gaining some popularity in the industry. And I'm not going to say much about lighthouse technology because Jim already covered that yesterday, and I think anything that I have to say about that is just going to be probably a duplication of of what he said, although I may have a few further comments on it. So, product temperature is the process variable that has the greatest potential impact on product quality. We've already said that, but we don't control it directly. And the idea behind this design space is establishing the relationship between the things you control and the thing that you don't control that you're really interested in. It's certainly needed. Product temperature measurement is certainly needed for laboratory scale development work. In a laboratory, you've got much better control of thermocouple placement. And most laboratory scale freeze dryers have a plexiglass door where you can basically see the whole array of vials. So it's a little more certain in a laboratory environment than it is in the manufacturing scale. We've got sight glasses in all our freeze dryers, but you can see part of one shelf. You don't in any way get a whole view of an entire shelf of vials, much less the whole dryer. But still, product temperature, a meaningful product temperature, can be very useful for scale-up studies. We know that for a given set of process conditions, primary drying, we're talking about shelf temperature, chamber pressure. If you scale that up to manufacturing equipment, even though you use the same process variables, it's going to take longer in a production environment. Now, Mike has said sort of his working hypothesis was it's because of the cleaner environment in manufacturing. You have much higher level of supercooling, faster freezing rate, slower drying. I'm not convinced that's the whole story, but I don't understand that very well myself. But still, it's very nice for doing scale-up studies, process validation, certainly. Transfers between manufacturing sites. Even within Baxter, I hope I'm not talking too much out of school, but we used to have a Baxter Bioscience division. They were spun off into another company a few years ago, and then they were bought by Shire Pharmaceutical. But back when they were still Bioscience, we have these manufacturing sites around the world. And they would periodically do transfers between different manufacturing sites, but every manufacturing site has their own way of doing things, and they always think they know best. And it became a problem when we realized, we'll get to it later, in comparative pressure measurement, you're looking at readings from two different gauges, the thermal conductivity type gauge and the capacitance manometer gauge. It's best practice to control with the capacitance manometer and monitor with the Pirani gauge. Some sites do it the reverse. They control with the Pirani gauge and monitor with the capacitance manometer. Well, that's not the same thing at all. And when you transfer between manufacturing sites using nominally the same set of process conditions, but if you monitor it differently like that, you cannot expect to get the same result. So it's really important to have same practices between manufacturing sites. It becomes an education problem, though. And then there's monitoring of routine production batches. At Baxter Bloomington, we hardly ever, in fact, in my tenure there, which has been 12 years, I don't believe we've ever monitored temperature in a production batch. It's because we use automatic loading unloading systems and trying to manage thermocouple leads and maintain asepsis. It just doesn't work. But some companies do. But I will say again that I believe that data integrity from routine monitoring of production batches using thermocouples or RTDs is highly suspect. Okay, types of temperature sensors. This is pretty elementary for a lot of you, I know, but I'll go through it anyway. If you take two wires made out of dissimilar metals and you join the ends and you put those two junctions at different temperatures, you get a voltage difference developed between what we would call the measuring junction and the reference junction, and a current flows in that circuit. It's called the Seebeck effect. The reference junction is usually an electronic simulation of an ice bath, although I don't know whether anybody uses physical ice baths anymore. Do you know, Drew? Do people still use ice baths as a thermocouple reference?
Certain AFB calibrated, some people still do. Mm-hmm. Because those mm-hmm. electronic ones are pretty expensive.
Uh-huh. And even though any two dissimilar metals, where you join the ends together, it forms a thermocouple of some kind, there are relatively few that are industrially important. And this is only there must be dozens of different kinds of thermocouples. And freeze drying, by far the most common one, is the type T thermocouple, copper constantan. And these are, I'm missing a data point there. That this is some very small number. They have different sensitivities. This microvolts per degree difference between measuring and reference junction is a measure of the sensitivity of that thermocouple. The type S thermocouple, when you get below 0 degrees, it becomes a very small number. I think this number is less than 10. So not really suitable for doing low temperature measurement. Some of them are not suitable for low temperatures for physical mechanical reasons, like the type J and iron constantan thermocouple becomes very brittle when you get below 0 degrees, so it becomes easy to break it, things like that. The type E is actually the most suitable for low temperatures. Notice the high number here, the sensitivity, below 0 degrees. And I've asked several people about that. You know, given this, why is the type E thermocouple really not used? And I still have not gotten an answer to that question. But the reality is most people use a type T thermocouple and it's just fine. I showed you this slide yesterday, but it's important to pay attention to the placement of the thermocouple, which is, well, a couple of things about this. One, use some kind of a device. This is a little overexposed. There are two holes in this Teflon insert, sits in the neck finish of this a 20 millimeter vial. And there's a stainless steel guide tube where you can thread the thermocouple through a hole here in this top flange, and the thermocouple is flexible enough. It goes around a little bend and enters this guide tube, and it holds it tightly enough that it doesn't move around on its own, but it's loose enough that you can slide the thermocouple up and down in the guide tube such that you get the length just right, so that the thermocouple tip is in the center of the vial, as close as we can get it, and actually touching the bottom. I mention this because there's a hard-to-die point of view in the industry that the thermocouple needs to be just off the bottom of the thermocouple. And I heard a talk by an engineer from a freeze-dryer manufacturer once saying the thermocouple needs to be just off the bottom of the vial. He said if you touch the bottom of the vial, you're measuring the temperature of the glass, not the temperature of the formulation. But that's based on the incorrect assumption that there's a temperature discontinuity between the bottom surface of the glass and the formulation that's in contact with that glass. In fact, there's no discontinuity. It's the same temperature. And the reason, there's a couple of reasons you want it to touch the bottom. One is that just off the bottom is a pretty subjective term. Just off the bottom for one person, it may not be just off the bottom for somebody else. But the more important reason is that you want the thermocouple to be in contact with the frozen material remaining just as long as you can, right up to the end of primary drying, if possible. Now, the sublimation front, given that the top surface here is flat when you fill the vial, starts out being flat, that it doesn't stay flat for long. It becomes curved like this, concave, if you viewed it from the bottom. The idea is that in addition to having heat coming upward from the vial, you have heat being transferred up the sidewall. The actual amount of area touching the shelf is very small. And you can take an ink pad with a vial and then put it on the ink pad and transfer it to a piece of graph paper. And you can, if you do that, you'll see how little direct contact there is. It's less than about 3% of the bottom area of the vial is actually touching the shelf. But the part that's best contact is right here, because particularly for molded vials, they've got they're much more concave. So the point is that you get heat being conducted up the sidewall as well as vertically upward from the bottom, and then that heat gets transferred laterally. So the area that's along the edge of the vial freeze dries more rapidly than that in the center. So that accounts for the shape. And the idea behind putting it here is, generally speaking, in even though there's a lot of randomness to the evolution of the shape of the sublimation front, it usually is a little bead of ice right in the bottom. So that's why it's important to put the thermocouple there. And we also use fine gauge thermocouple wire. Resistance temperature detectors, also called resistance thermometer, resistance bulb, all the same thing. And it's based on the idea that the resistance of a metal changes in a reproducible way with the temperature of that metal. The most common one, I think, is 100 ohm platinum RTD. It's just a winding of wire around some core material, might be ceramic or something like that. I'm not really sure what the roster of materials looks like, but a typical resistance bulb looks like that. This is a RTD I got this slide from Arnab at EMA Life. Notice how big it is. I put a ruler here. That's about a half a centimeter long. So you can see that it's a completely different kind of measurement than a thermocouple measurement is. This is measurement at a point. It's where the tips of those two wires are joined together. This is an area measurement. In other words, you get an average value over the entire area of the exposed part of the RTD. So you can't expect to get the same result. In fact, for a typical fill volume, the fill volume might be, roughly this level in a vial. So before freeze drying proceeds too far, you've got part of the RTD sticking out that's actually embedded in the partly dried material. The other part is it's still embedded in the frozen material. So as I said, you're getting an average temperature over the whole exposed area of the bulb. It will not be the same as the thermocouple measurement. This is have you ever seen this kind of a device? It's called an ELAB. This is an RTD type device. In contrast to this last one, notice how bulky it is. The sensing element in this, shown right here at the tip of this lead, there's a close-up view shown here with a ruler. It's only a couple of millimeters long and maybe a couple of millimeters wide. The idea is that the smaller the sensing element becomes, of course, the more it approximates a point measurement. And there again, would expect the output to be quite different is in the EMA Life RTD with the photograph that I showed you. We use this a lot in Bloomington, we don't actually. The people who do validation, they use these for validation work on stability storage chambers, where they're validating instruments that are measuring process temperatures, dry heat ovens, and so forth. So this kind of advice, basically, it's wireless in a sense. It still has a lead, but the data gets stored in this capsule, and then it's put on a reader station. So you don't get real-time data. It's sort of batch-wise data on product temperature. You've still got the lead to deal with. You've still got the uncertainty of placing this in a vial of product. You still need a way to hold it in a secure position. You're dealing with a somewhat stiffer wire. We like to use fine-gauge thermocouple wire just because it's flexible and easy to handle. This is less flexible and less easy to handle, and it translates to more uncertainty about where the temperature measurement element really is. But it's worthy of a mention in the context of temperature measurement in freeze drying and even more broadly in pharmaceutical processing. Yeah.
Actually, I'm working with someone from ELAB right now, and they have a real-time...
A Skylab? What's it called, Skylab?
I'm not sure what it's called.
Yeah.
It reads real-time now.
Thank you. I was going to mention that.
Data logs.
I was about to forget to mention that this technology has evolved where you do get real-time transmission of the temperature data. Have you used it?
Yes, I've had the person in the lab, and I'm evaluating it. Several different things he has. One is a surface temperature measurement. Two is a point RTD like that.
Mm-hmm.
And another one is a wireless piranha.
A wireless piranha, yes. Okay. How's that worked out?
Not so good yet.
Mm-hmm. We have one, and it's it also hasn't worked out so well for us either. I guess that would come under the heading of developing technology. Someone told me that the wireless Brani is a plus or minus 20% instrument. If that's true, it, for us anyway, it would have limited use. Okay, RTDs versus thermocouples, most any way you compare them, the RTD is going to win in terms of accuracy, precision, linearity, stability, less frequent calibration, certainly, fewer temperature points when you do calibration. These are very important as sort of standards for fixed temperatures, for temperatures between the fixed measurement points and the National Bureau of Standards stuff. The general advantages of thermocouples, such as, they're more robust, useful at higher temperatures and harsher environment, mechanical agitation, vibration, faster response time. None of these really apply to freeze drying. But the main reasons that we tend to use thermocouples over RTDs is because of what I've already mentioned, which is that we're talking about a specific point measurement. We want the temperature measurement element to be in contact with frozen material, right up to the end of primary drying if we can. A little bit about the Tempra system. The Tempra system is a wireless system. It's not a thermocouple. It's not an RTD. And I'm not well qualified to tell you exactly how it works, except that you have a transmitter that transmits a microwave signal, and that the temperature measuring element that's shown here responds in a way that is a function of temperature. That's about all I can say about it at this point. So you've got a fairly bulky sensor, and I'll add a very expensive sensor. I'm not sure exactly. I think these are a couple thousand dollars a piece. We are sort of kicking the tires on this, and there's an antenna that sticks out the top here. And so basically a broadcast signal, and then an answering response. So, the nice thing about this, we have one in Bloomington. All of the instrumentation is external to the freeze dryer. You don't really have to install it. So we can take a Tempra system in the lab and carry it right over to production if we want to, and set it up and monitor a production batch. That's nice that there's no installation required. The sensing element's relatively bulky compared to the thermocouple or the ELAB RTD. One concern we have about this, if I can back up a minute, if you're dealing with a relatively small depth of fill in a vial, the presence of that bulky sensor is going to increase the depth of fill, and it could artificially prolong the length of primary drying. So that's something you need to be aware of as a source of uncertainty. What about the antenna during stoppering? It's going to get smashed, but it's flexible enough wire. You can usually bend it right back into position, so they're reusable. And in the event that you do break one, it's pretty inexpensive. You can replace those antennae. The expensive piece is the bulk of the sensing element itself. The antenna doesn't mount to much, so this really is not much of a limitation, even though it is going to get smashed when you stopper the vials. This is our manufacturing area. This is the back of an EMA Life freeze dryer. This is just a sight glass. You've got to have a sight glass for that transmission and receiving the responding signal. Of course, this is the sensor in a vial of product sticking through the top of a LIO closure. My colleague Greg Sasha and I have played with this in production, and this is the transmitter and the receiver. Notice that we've just got this stuck by means of a suction cup to the side with the stainless steel cladding on the freeze dryer. It seems to stay in place quite well, and you could put that right up against the sight glass. And what we wanted to determine is being able to send and receive signals affected by where a vial is placed in a relatively large production freeze dryer. It turns out that in our hands anyway, it doesn't matter where we put it, we can still get the signal. So at least that's a start. And I've showed you some slides of our fill line where I shouldn't have any trouble convincing you that, you know, you're going to have a tough time putting a thermocouple vial in there. But you can take a pair of sterile forceps, and there are places where you could insert this monitored vial on a filling line, and it would just be incorporated with the rest of the vials in the loading system. There are no leads to get in the way. This is the size of the sensing element. There again, I've put it on a ruler. So what's that, about a centimeter and a half from one end to another? The antenna attaches right here. The actual part that senses temperature, though, is right here, this little almost like a button at the bottom. That's only about a millimeter deep. So that's the part that's actually sensing the temperature. And this is Sergei Cheselov's work that he provided, where we're comparing the temperature sensor with a traditional thermocouple. And what I want to point out is that during freezing, the red line is the thermocouple in the center of the tray. The blue line is the temperature system in the center of the tray. Notice they're right on top of one another during freezing. They're right on top of each other as we start primary drying and getting into primary drying until here. What do you suppose has happened at this point? The two readings depart. And hey, there's no penalty for wrong answers. Take a guess.
DC loses contact with the ice.
Yeah. The sublimation front has passed the tip of the thermocouple, and when it breaks away, it's very subject to small differences in the position of the thermocouple. What's going on here is that the temperature system has stayed in contact with the ice much longer. So if I can go back to this a minute, this is also an area measurement, but notice that it's a very different kind of an area measurement compared to the EMALIFE RTD, which extends a long ways vertically in the vial. This is an area measurement that extends farther horizontally. So you might expect, hey, it's going to remain in contact with the ice longer than the tip of a thermocouple will. And that's why I say that, you know, some kind of a system like this is, I hope, becomes a best practice in the future. So there again, the reason is the thermocouple, because its output is so position dependent. And once the sublimation front crosses the tip of the thermocouple, the temperature comes up because the thermocouple is embedded in the partly dried layer now. Actually, I don't know. I'll bet it was touching. But there again, there's a lot of randomness. It doesn't always happen that the last ice to disappear is right in the center because of just variability in evolution of the shape of that sublimation front. So it may have been a little bit off center, or maybe the last ice to disappear wasn't at the bottom center of the vial, or maybe it wasn't even touching the bottom. But the point is that it loses contact with ice much before this one does. And if you look at the edge vials, again, you see the same sort of thing. The two temperatures are right on top of each other during freezing, early in primary drying at this point. Now, at the edge, we're going to expect, you know, that shape of the sublimation front may not be symmetrical because you're getting all this heating from the side. Maybe the last ice to disappear isn't in the center of the vial at all. But the point is that the thermocouple loses contact with the frozen system much longer than the Tempra system did. This is just our own data comparing in the blue lines a product thermocouple, and the red lines is the Tempra system. So notice there's much more variability, a much wider range. This is really the transition from primary drying to secondary drying to approaching end of secondary drying. The point is that all of the Tempra traces cover a much smaller range of temperature than the thermocouple does. Again, I'm sure it arises from the position dependence of the results of the thermocouple, this appears to be a much more robust system. Again, because it's an area measurement, but it's maybe more the right type of an area measurement in this. So that's why I think that some kind of a wireless system is going to become best practice before too many years. Okay, we have to talk a little bit about disadvantages of all product temperature measurement methods. I probably shouldn't say all. I should probably say most. And that really boils down to the idea that a monitored vial, if you have a temperature sensing element of any kind, whether it's a Tempra or a thermocouple or an RTD, it's going to influence the freezing behavior of the vial that it's placed in, simply because it acts as a foreign body and tends to trigger ice nucleation and minimizes the amount of supercooling. So because they supercool less, in effect, they freeze slower. They have a larger average ice crystal size. They freeze faster than the rest of the batch, on average about 10%. Although we really need more comparative data here. There's very little that's been published on this. And what we've done, we never have gotten around to publishing. But I think 10% or so is a pretty good estimate of the bias introduced by a temperature measuring element. Must have ways of dealing with bad data. This really applies more to a production environment where you might break a thermocouple, or you don't have a good electrical connection between the thermocouple and the thermocouple jack on the freeze dryer. Thermocouples can also get stuck in the door gasket. Wouldn't necessarily affect the temperature data integrity, but it certainly causes a leak in the freeze dryer. Not compatible with automated material handling systems. And the other point worth making is that putting these temperature sensing elements in a vial of product is almost always a manual process. So you've got a person in close proximity, even though you're going to throw, you never keep a thermocouple vial. You always throw those away. But still, there is the potential to compromise asepsis of an entire array of vials, particularly if you're reaching over it. Although I did see a videotape recently. If we have time at the end, maybe I'll show it to you. Sergey sent that to me, Tony, that shows a robotic system that puts the Tempra system in a vial. Have you ever seen that? Yeah, Sergey has it. It's interesting. I didn't realize, because they're really seriously into incorporating automatic insertion of a temperature measuring device on a filling line. I've never seen that before. I was impressed by it. Based on the videotape, hey, it seems to work great. I just have a feeling, though, that the technology that kind of ends up winning this will be something probably other than a Tempra system. I've already mentioned that, you know, they're very expensive measuring elements, and a production environment can be kind of rough on equipment like that. This, we've already mentioned that influence of a temperature sensor on ice nucleation temperature. This is just something to compare with. What we did is look at the Tempra system versus a normal thermocouple, center of the vial, touching the bottom. And then we also put a thermocouple on the outside surface of a vial. The idea there is that you can still detect ice nucleation without having something touching the product. And there's really, each one of these data points represents one vial, supercooling for one vial. There's no significant difference between the TEMPUR system and a thermocouple that's placed in the vial. Those are not significant differences. Notice they range from about what, -7.5 to maybe -16.5, a little over -16. Slightly higher range here, no big deal. But outside the thermocouple, there, yes, there is a significant difference. In this case, the extent of supercooling varies from about -12 to, look, as much as almost -24 degrees. And the average here is about a 4 degree difference. So that matters. Now, one comment you might make is, hey, if you're putting a thermocouple on the outside of the vial, that's bias too. Well, it is a little bit. We've compared thermocouple outside the vial with thermocouple inside the same vial. And the differences in nucleation temperatures is well under a half a degree C. So there's a little bit of bias there, in my opinion, not something you really need to worry about. This data is much more representative of vials that are just part of a large array of vials in a freeze dryer. Okay, pressure measurement. I've mentioned there are all kinds of pressure measuring devices. We have the thermal conductivity type gauge. There are two of those. One is a thermocouple gauge. The other is a Pirani gauge. A thermocouple gauge is a pretty low price, can't calibrate it, only going to find it on really inexpensive laboratory type freeze dryers. Not an instrument of choice at all when you're spending a lot of money for a pharmaceutical freeze dryer. The Pirani gauge is much better. And then the capacitance manometer. So, in a Pirani gauge, two filaments are basically become the arms of a Wheatstone bridge. One filament's the reference, maintaining a constant pressure and gas phase composition. The other filament is the measurement filament. In a Pirani gauge, the filament temperature is controlled at a constant value. Both of the, or the, no matter how you do it, any thermoconductivity gauge is based on the principle that the rate of heat loss from a heated filament varies as a function of pressure in the system. It's not a linear relationship, but you want it to at least vary in a reproducible way. The filament temperature is controlled at a constant value. The Pirani gauge has about 100 times the range of a thermocouple gauge. So in this best practice paper, we stated that best practice for process monitoring in pharmaceutical freeze drying is that you want a capacitance manometer on both the chamber and the condenser, and you want a Pirani gauge on both the chamber and a condenser. I'm surprised by the number of people who will spend, what, $2 or $3 million on a production scale freeze dryer, and then they'll only put one pressure gauge on it. You know, Alina Alexenko has said, geez, I've got at least 4 pressure gauges on my $35,000 car. Why would somebody spend all that money on a freeze dryer and then decide that you're going to economize on process instrumentation? It really is a good example, in my opinion, of false economy. By all means, spend what you need to monitor a process appropriately. So again, Pirani gauge, thermal conductivity type gauge, very useful in freeze drying. Every freeze dryer should have a couple of them at least. Oh, yeah. Pirani gauges and organic solvents. There's a lot of concern about that industry, and rightly there should be, because keep in mind we've got a heated filament and we've got potentially explosive vapor. There was a nice piece of work done by an EMAlife guy named Dan Gunderud a few years ago, and he sort of did this exhaustive analysis of where the risk is. Keeping in mind that there, in order to have an explosion, two conditions have to be met. You have to have a high enough concentration of vapor for it to ignite, and you have to have enough oxygen there to support combustion. During primary drying and freeze drying, neither condition is met. But where you do run the highest risk, according to Dan, is right at the, when you first pull a vacuum, because consider that you're filling a large batch of a formulation that contains a co-solvent system of water and tertiary butanol. So you've got vapor building up in the freeze dryer, you know, while you're holding it, while you're filling the whole freeze dryer, and then once you start freezing, you've got quite a bit of vapor there. And when you first pull a vacuum, that's when you have the potential of both conditions being met. So it's fair to concern, to be concerned in Bloomington, whenever we're dealing with a formulation that has a co-solvent in it, we simply turn off the Pirani gauge. We don't use them. In our sister facility in Halle, they flush the system with nitrogen before they start freezing. Both methods seem to work fine. So again, fair concern, but it's no justification for not using a Pirani gauge. Also, there's a widely held perception, even in Bloomington, that you can't steam sterilize a Pirani gauge. In other words, that this repeated steam sterilization will cause the filament to fail. I can't remember who I talked to. I think it was Paul Quado at SP Scientific. He's actually done some work on it. And it is true that there are all kinds of different filaments for Pirani gauges, and they do seem to vary in how robust they are against failure caused by repeated steam sterilization. But the point is that there are Pirani gauges out there that will withstand. I think he's steam sterilized up to 50 or 60 times. No sign of failure. They seem to last almost indefinitely. But we need a little more information on that, about exactly what kind of filaments are really robust and what filaments are less so. Okay. So a thermal conductivity gauge, the response depends on not only the pressure in the system, but the composition of the vapor phase that's being measured. And in freeze drying, we have the composition of the vapor in the system that goes from essentially 100% water vapor during primary drying. This only if, even when you're injecting nitrogen to control pressure, it seems like there's only a couple percent there. Do you agree with that,
yeah,
Drew? Yeah. You've probably done more mass spec work in freeze drying than anybody has. So to essentially 100% nitrogen by the time we get to secondary drying, and basically, with comparative pressure measurement, we use this characteristic to our advantage as a process monitoring tool. So the capacitance manometer. Any capacitor, capacitance type transducer, works in one of two ways. It either keeps the dielectric constant in that transducer the same and varies geometry, or it keeps geometry the same and varies dielectric constant. In the capacitance manometer pressure gauge, it's the geometry that changes, where you have one side of the transducer that's evacuated to something like 10 to the minus 7th torr and sealed using an Inconel metal, a high quality stainless steel. The other side is exposed to the process, and the diaphragm then flexes as a function of temperature in the system. So it is the pressure measuring gauge of choice for a freeze dryer. I go back long enough that I remember there was a lot of debate with freeze dryer manufacturers that didn't really want to spend that, because it is a relatively expensive gauge. And it took some convincing to get them to realize that that's the gauge you really want to use, simply because it's so, this is what one looks like on one of our lab freeze dryers. Again, we have them both on chamber and condenser. The response is independent of the gas phase composition, so it truly measures force per unit area, true pressure. They're very linear over about four orders of magnitude of pressure. So it's the kind of pressure measuring gauge we've just never had any trouble with. So with that as a little bit of background, I want to talk a little bit more about some alternatives to product temperature monitoring, or at least added data. The first one is comparative pressure measurement. I showed you a graph at least once yesterday where we're using the capacitance manometer to control pressure in the chamber throughout the cycle. The thermocouple type gauge, the Pirani gauge in this case, we only monitor the apparent pressure. We realize it's not the true pressure because its response depends on the composition of the vapor phase. But if we do that, we might get data that looks like this, where this is the shelf temperature. The red line is the chamber pressure as measured and controlled with the capacitance manometer. Note it's at 75 millitorr. These are product temperature traces. So during primary drying, we have what we call a pseudo steady state. We get a pressure reading from the Prandtl gauge that's about 60% higher than the pressure reading of the capacitance manometer. It's because the conductance of water vapor is about 60% more than nitrogen. At this point, we're starting to be done with primary drying. And the apparent pressure goes down, true pressure not changing, and actually approaches the capacitance manometer. Now, I don't know whether you do this, but we do in our lab, where you can set up a cycle where you advance from primary to secondary drying conditions based on this difference. You just put in a delta P, and we'll use 5 or 6 or 7 millitorr as the delta P that we'll use to trigger going from primary drying. It's a very handy thing to have available. So when those criteria are met, the shelf temperature advances to secondary drying, in this case 35 degrees. The apparent pressure goes up because we're driving unfrozen water off the system. It reaches a peak and then tails back off, comes back to the capacitance manometer pressure. And at that point, you're as dry as you're going to get, at least at that shelf temperature. If you jacked it up more, you'd get more water coming off. But we're already on the, fairly high end. That's a relatively high temperature to use for secondary drying, that 35 degrees. So again, the advantage of it is that we're not putting anything in any vials of product. We're monitoring the batch as a whole, and we're determining when primary drying is over and when secondary drying is over. One thing that I'll mention before I go on, because I have a conversation going with Ray Fong. Ray was Mike's last, she was a graduate student of both Robin Bogner and Mike. And she just graduated this spring. She works with Merck now. And there's some disagreement about what's going on during this transition. In other words, the question is, at what point has the ice disappeared from the last vial? Ray told me recently that by the time this gauge starts going down, 97% of the vials are done. 97% of the vials have no ice left in them. And she does great work. I trust her. I'm not sure I agree with her, because we've done thief sampling in here and still found ice present in some vials. So maybe it's formulation dependent. I'm really not sure, but I mention it as a source of uncertainty about what's really going on between here and here in the context of when has the last ice disappeared from that batch. I guess the answer is we really don't know, and we need some more information. When we're doing studies on the influence of residual moisture on drug product stability, we will actually start sampling here. And as I said, we will occasionally find a vial that still has ice in it. But most of the batch in for a typical formulation contains about 5% residual moisture. And then we'll take samples throughout until we're done here, where we're trying to cover a broad range of residual moisture levels, then doing stress stability studies on those. Okay. It gives us information on the status of the product during freeze drying without any type of sensors in individual vials. It's inexpensive. It's robust. It's sensitive. It's very useful monitoring of scale up of cycles developed in lab equipment and transferred to production equipment. Based on my years doing this kind of work, one of the best ways to fail is to take the same time, temperature, pressure relationship that you develop in the lab and just transfer that to a production freeze dryer. It has a high chance of failure because it's going to take longer in the production freeze dryer, and you must monitor that cycle. It's a hard point to get across to a lot of production manufacturing organizations, that they think, hey, you're supposed to have already have done this work. You're supposed to know how long this cycle is going to take. Well, the truth is, no, we don't. You have to really monitor those cycles. And we've had some really expensive and troublesome failures based around that same idea. I want to go back and elaborate just a little bit. I said that best practice, according to this group, this working group that, that did the paper, is to have both a capacitance manometer and a Pirani gauge on both the chamber and the condenser. Well, the Pirani gauge, both Pirani gauge and capacitance manometer on the chamber, because it enables this comparative measure, pressure measurement technique. Okay. Why do you need a capacitance manometer on the condenser as well? Because it's useful, particularly for doing equipment capability measurement, you can get useful information from the pressure drop between the chamber and the condenser, particularly when you're pushing the limits of equipment capability, when you're likely to get a significant temperature or pressure difference, between the chamber and the condenser. In fact, there's published data. Mike did some work on this. I think Sajal Patel was involved as well, that when the pressure ratio reaches about 3-1 chamber to condenser, that's generally taken as being confirming of choked flow in that freeze dryer. So the reason you want both is that it can be a useful indication of where you are with respect to approaching the limit of the capability of a freeze dryer. Okay, so the last piece of that is, why do you want a Pirani gauge on the condenser too? Well, it's a good idea because, one, they're not very expensive, and two, it's useful as a troubleshooting tool. In freeze drying, you're going to have periodic leaks in the system, and what you want to do is, as quickly as you can, find out where that leak came from. And if you're able to isolate the chamber from the condenser, hey, you've just eliminated half of the potential problem. So even in the laboratory, sometimes we'll start to pull a vacuum, and it won't pull a vacuum. We don't have Pirani gauges on our condensers, but the reason I want one is that the first thing we do is close the valve between the chamber and the condenser and see which side. First, find out if the condenser is working okay. If that's working okay, you turn your attention to the chamber. If you don't have a Pirani gauge on the condenser, you really don't know. The nice thing about a Pirani gauge is it may not give you very accurate pressure information at just below atmospheric pressure, but it does respond right away. As soon as you get below atmospheric pressure, you're going to get a reading from the Pirani gauge. So it just makes troubleshooting much quicker and more convenient, and it's certainly worth the money. This has been around for a while. I mention it for the sake of completion. You basically close the valve between the chamber and the condenser and watch what happens to the pressure in the chamber. The idea is when you've got no more water vapor coming off the product, the pressure rise is minimal. It's in principle, it only becomes the background leak rate of that freeze dryer, which should be very small. As I said before, it assumes a low and roughly constant background leak rate. This is just some representative process data. This is a Pirani gauge, but notice every one of these represents a pressure rise measurement. And what you're trying to do is reach some minimum value, or I should say that a maximum value of pressure rise that would correspond to adequate dryness. And that has to be determined basically by trial and error. Been around for a long time. We don't use it, but it's worthy of a mention. Some people have put mass flow meters on the gas bleed line, the nitrogen line, assuming you're using nitrogen to bleed in for pressure control. The idea is that during primary drying, again, you've got mostly water vapor in the chamber. The mass flow rate of the bleed gas is minimal. But then as you approach the end of primary drying, in order to keep the pressure constant, you bleed in more nitrogen. So that's worthy of mention as a process monitoring tool. In our world, we don't have a mass flow meter, but you can measure the degree to which the bleed valve is open, be somewhere between 0 and 100%. That can give you the same kind of information. Manometric temperature measurement. This is a work that a graduate student of mine, Nate Milton, did back in the mid 90s. But it's a variation on the pressure rise method, and it's intended to measure product temperature without using temperature probes. And what we do, it's a variation of the pressure rise method, but instead of doing it as we think we're approaching the end of a cycle, we do it during primary drying itself. You can't leave that valve closed for very long, not more than maybe 20, 25 seconds. But you then during that time, you measure the transient pressure response during the time that valve is closed. And this was a sort of a case study in how smart Mike Pakal was. He was at Eli Lilly at the time, and he came up to visit one day here on campus, gave a seminar, and we were just talking, and I mentioned this idea that, you know, it seems like you ought to be able to close that valve, monitor the transient pressure, model that response, and come up with useful information. Well, about 2 days later, this was back when we used fax machines a lot, he had all the equations worked out, and they all worked the first time. So he was probably the best quantitative thinker I've ever known. Really a smart guy, and I miss him all the time. So the idea of this manometric temperature measurement is you've got a lot of things going on. You're cooking along during primary drying, and you close this valve. So all of a sudden, vapor's got nowhere to go, and the pressure's going to build up just because of because you've stopped the sublimation process. Okay, so there's a sublimation process itself, but then you've got other things going on during the time the valve is closed. Even though it's not very long, but it's long enough that you can get some heating of the product during that measurement interval, and you need to compensate for that. The other thing is that when you stop the process, this temperature gradient across the frozen layer tends to dissipate, and you can model that. But basically, you combine these equations, you measure the transient pressure response, you fit the equation to, there are three variables in there. One is the, let's see if I can remember. There's the resistance of the dried product layer. There's the vial heat transfer coefficient, and then there's the sublimation rate itself. And if you look at that, these are the three components. You know, the sublimation, stopping the sublimation, heating the product, dissipating the temperature gradient, and this is the sum of all three. This dotted line. And if you superimpose that on the experimental data, it's a really good fit. I was really impressed by that. So this has become the basis for the smart freeze dryer technology, except it goes beyond that. We didn't really pursue it much beyond Nate's PhD thesis, but SP moved that forward. And basically, it allows someone to approach optimal drying conditions by making these measurements and appropriate changes in process variables to get a very acceptable freeze-dry cycle with a minimal amount of experimentation. So from this, you can get product temperature, product resistance to mass transfer, vial heat transfer coefficient. I wouldn't do it this way, but in principle, you can. And of course, you get the sublimation rate. But if you're interested in doing a graphical design space and you have smart freeze dryer, you know, this is the main variable that you're interested in. This is just an example, of product resistance obtained by what we call MTM. Product resistance as a function of time, or product resistance as a function of depth of the partly dried layer, however you want to think of it. This is a mannitol-based formulation, and mannitol-based formulations tend to have a relatively high resistance to mass transfer, and it tends to increase pretty rapidly. This is calcium chloride. It increases, but not as rapidly. This one is what threw us for a loop. This was lactose. Notice how it goes up a little bit, and then it just flattens out, and we thought there was something really wrong with the whole, that we were missing something important about the whole idea of modeling this transient pressure response. I'm bleeding. So we explored this in a little bit more detail. And what Nate found out was that we happened to be freeze drying this at a temperature close to the collapse temperature of lactose. And when he was very conservative with the freeze-dry cycle and took an SEM photomicrograph of the freeze-dried solid, he got these, oh, kind of a general, common sort of image of plates of amorphous material. But as he made the cycle more aggressive and started to approach the collapse temperature, this is what the dried material looked like. It starts to look like Swiss cheese. Now, you can't see this in looking at the vial of freeze-dried product, but you can also see it's got a bunch of holes in it. And it's not hard to imagine that you're going to have lower resistance to mass transfer when water vapor can shoot right through these holes as opposed to making its way around these plates of material. But I thought it was a good example of using that kind of process data. And hey, we learned something about the process. There was nothing wrong with what we were doing. It was just that we didn't understand the influence of the morphology of the freeze-dried product on the resistance of the dried product layer. And it's why collapse can become self-limiting. In other words, you start to get some micro-collapse. You've still got a structure there. You can't see this in the vial of product, but by decreasing the resistance, you increase the sublimation rate. You increase the sublimation rate. It needs more heat, so it cools the product. So in that way, collapse has a tendency to sort of correct itself, at least in some systems. You can't say that for all of them. Does that make sense? I hope. What haven't I said about this? Okay, I think I've already covered it. Oh, I want to talk about TDLAS. We've referred to it several times. We've got three TDLAS instruments in our lab, and it's and we keep them all pretty busy. It's pretty much the mainstay of our approach to freeze-dry cycle development. Jim Veal already talked about part of this yesterday. What he was talking about is really sort of essentially the same as TDLAS. Except they're not measuring velocity. And in the TDLS instrument, we not only measure the concentration of the absorbing gas, we measure how fast it's moving between the chamber and the condenser so that we have an optical fiber that shoots into the duct between the chamber and the condenser at a 45 degree angle. So it enters by means of a sight glass on one side, and then on the other side of the duct, down on the downstream side, we have the detector or signal processing electronics. And I think it's generally called a Doppler shift absorption spectroscopy, based on the idea that you get an absorption maximum that shifts depending on the velocity of that water vapor. So you can measure both velocity and concentration. So there's then a density component, a velocity component, and if you know the geometry of the freeze dryer, it's fairly simple math to determine the instantaneous mass flow rate. This is just the shift, the frequency shift between the reference point, and there's a cell in the electronics of the TDLAS that contains water vapor. Of course, it's not moving at a known partial pressure. If you're not familiar with TDLAS, this is what the screen looks like. This is the reference. The white one is the reference. The yellow one is the process signal. The greater the shift in frequency there, the faster the water vapor is moving. So we get a readout of velocity. If you can't read that, it's 137 and something meters per second. A mass flow rate, and then this totals the whole amount of mass removed along with the runtime. This is what the optics look like on a laboratory freeze dryer. If you're not really familiar with this, most connecting ducts, the chambers up here, the condensers down here, it's usually just a straight pipe with a valve between chamber and the condenser at the bottom here. But in this case, it's got the fiber optic hardware. There's a detector, there's a transmitter and a receiver, one way, another transmitter and receiver. Another way that you get more sensitivity with this two line of sight instrument. You can, there again, in principle, you can take the same instrument and move it from the lab to production, provided you have the appropriate hardware and the production equipment. The last purchase of freeze dryers at Baxter was actually before my time, but they had the foresight to put blanked off flanges between chamber and in this duct. This, the chamber's over here, condenser's over here, blanked off flange here and here, blanked off flanges at the same position on the other side of that duct. So if we want to use TDLES, you take this flange off, you put this non-reflective glass window in, you put this collimator housing on top of it, and you've got some adjustment gimbals that you can use to line up the laser with the detector. This goes on the other side of the freeze dryer downstream. That's the detector, and then a cable that goes from there. So there again, yes, there is installation required because you've got to put the optical hardware in, and it can be tricky to get it lined up. In other words, to get the laser to hit the bullseye on the other side of the connecting duct. But you can do it, and you can get useful information that way. We do this for clients who want to monitor a stability batch or an engineering batch or something. It's not used at all in routine production. And this is an example of process data from production, where this is the mass flow rate, the orange line there. This is a case where a client came to us with a cycle already developed. It happens pretty frequently. In our world, anytime an analytical method is transferred from a client to the Baxter QC lab, it always goes through R&D to sort of kick the tires on the method. They don't do that in freeze-dry processing, and they really should, because this freeze-dry cycle has got some what would appear to be some wasted time. It says that you're pretty much done right here, and then you've got this two-step secondary drying process where, according to the mass flow rate, this is just riding right along at zero. It says, gee, you could probably save a lot of time on this cycle if you worked on it. However, if you use just the density part of the TDLES, remember I said there's two signals, there's velocity and density. If you do this, you kind of get something equivalent to a Pirani gauge, that you do get more water vapor coming off. It doesn't amount to much in terms of mass, but here we've increased the shelf temperature, secondary drying, goes up and back down, increased it again, goes up and back down. Again, we're not talking about what much mass of material, but you're still indicating that, yes, you're getting some secondary drying taking place. It's just that you could have started it much earlier. So, applications of TDLES. Well, we use it for vial heat transfer coefficient, resistance of the dried product layer, equipment capability, whether it's a choke point or minimum controllable pressure, useful for both. And then, of course, construction of a primary drying design space that we use all those things to do. And I hope that's looking familiar by now. This is the stuff that Jim Veal talked about yesterday. I'll see what else I have to say about it. Maybe nothing. He's already talked about that, the moisture mapping study. He presented some data that I had not seen, but I like to show this slide. One, it's a really good example of improved process understanding, knowing where the high residual moisture vials are most likely to be. And I've never really liked this tradition of an X-shaped sampling plan where you go corner, 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 center. It seems to me that you ought to focus your samples more in the center of the array if you're interested in picking up vials that have a higher residual moisture level than you want. And a lot of the sampling plans in routine production, I don't think they hold up very well to statistical scrutiny, because you may only take one vial out of a freeze dryer that might have 30, 40, 50,000 vials in it. Is that one vial representative? Well, you really don't know. And you need to at least pay attention to where you take that vial from. He's already mentioned that. I don't know whether he mentioned this. I thought it was an interesting case study where they suspected a raised stopper issue, batch of 11,000 vials that were put into quarantine. And it was basically an investigation to determine, well, was every, so there were three sublots, I believe, and they were trying to determine whether every sublot was affected. And these kind of decisions have become really important, especially in an era of protein therapeutic agents that are really expensive. You don't want to throw away a product that you really shouldn't have to throw away. But it illustrates the value of this kind of non-destructive testing. It showed that the raised stopper issue was localized to one freeze dryer and not all of the freeze dryers in that batch. So considering the price of these, they probably paid for the instrumentation many, many times over just with this one investigation. Okay, so that's all I have to say for now about process monitoring.